Awesome. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. February 11th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. And I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2177. Mr. Bender.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members. I'm Steve Bender with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Today you have scheduled a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2177 relating to elections. I would like to point out just briefly the materials that we have for you on OLIS for this. I know this is your first work session this session, so please familiarize yourselves with the materials that we will be providing. If you look at your subcommittee meeting date for today, February 11th, you will see that we actually have two items that are titled 2177 in the list of meeting materials. I will be working through the item that's called House Bill 2177 LFO Work Session Materials. This item will include a memo describing the bill. It includes our fiscal impact statement for the bill. It would include the revenue impact statement if there was one, but for this particular bill, there's no revenue impact. And it includes the staff measure summary from the committee to which referred this bill to you. Most of these items are available elsewhere where they normally are in OLIS additionally. However, they're all combined in this document for your convenience. So I will be looking at that. You'll also see that there was one item of testimony that was submitted to the committee prior to the meeting that has also been stored onto OLIS. If I may, though,
please.
House Bill 2177 comes to you from the House Committee on Rules. They held a public hearing on this bill on February 2nd, and on February 4th, they recommended that the measure do pass, and they referred it to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The co-chairs of the Joint Committee referred this bill to this subcommittee for work session. What this bill does is that it has a number of provisions, both provisions with fiscal impact and provisions without fiscal impact. Our documentation deals primarily with the provisions that have fiscal impact, so I'll mention the other items as well, just so it's clear and on the record. But the primary provision of this bill that generates the fiscal impacts that we are talking about here is that House Bill 2177 would allow certain electronic records of the Department of Transportation to be constituted as a completed voter registration card, and the bill directs ODOT to provide the Secretary of State with records, electronic records, including name, age, residence, and citizenship information, and electronic signatures for that particular purpose. Persons identified by the Secretary of State as qualified to vote but not already registered will be added to the elector registration list unless they decline within 21 days of being so notified. The provisions of the measure, these provisions of the measure do have fiscal impacts to the Secretary of State, to counties, and to the Oregon Department of Transportation. Those are shown on our fiscal impact statement, which is included in this particular work session materials document, or is available also as on the analysis tab for this particular bill. The fiscal impact that we are estimating for this bill includes a cost during the 15-17 biennium of approximately $750,000 to the Secretary of State, and of approximately $770,000 to counties. Costs in the subsequent or following biennium drop off to approximately $43,000 for the Secretary of State and continue to increase somewhat to about $825,000 for counties. The costs to the Secretary of State are largely relate to the implementation of the measure and are one-time in nature. That is why our fiscal impact analysis is showing the costs declining so much after the 15-17 biennium. These costs include hardware and software upgrades to the Secretary of State's existing Oregon Central Voter Registration System to allow the provisions of the bill to be implemented. So they are requesting, they have requested, and LFO would recommend acknowledging costs related to implementing the bill. The Secretary of State has also asked that you would approve a limited one biennium position, one position, 0.5 FTE, for a project manager to oversee the implementation of the program. Secretary of State's other costs relate to costs of notifying voters of their option to opt out of registration and to affiliate with a political party. These costs are largely independent of the number of new voters that become added to the registration rolls as a result of this measure. The county costs, on the other hand, will be more directly related to the number of voters that are added to the rolls. The additional costs to counties that we've included in this measure represent costs to them of mailing additional ballots, because as registered voters, these individuals will now be mailed ballots, and also the costs of tabulating additional ballots. As more ballots come in, this increases those costs of tabulation. The costs that we are estimating are based on an estimated increase in the number of registered voters of approximately 438,000 by the end of the current biennium. We believe these costs are at the high end, and the actual costs might be to the counties might be lower than this, because this number assumes that essentially everyone that is that registers to vote that isn't already in the central voter registration list with DMV information is not already registered to vote. But we do know that some people are already registered to vote even though they don't have specific DMV information in the system already. So this is sort of a high-end estimate. There are a number of provisions of the bill that do not have fiscal impact that are found beginning in section 6 of the bill. These provisions permit the maximum precinct size to include 10,000 electors. Currently, there's a limit of 5,000. They can include provisions that in section 8 that prevent disclosure of information for people who are registered before they are age 18, until they are age 18. So if someone comes to the DMV to register at age 16, that information would not be made public until they're 18. And it also basically, for one election, freezes the qualification of the number of members of a group of voters must have in order to form a minor political party. Unless there are any questions, I would want to note that, we can wait the recommendation until the work session.
Thank you.
Sure, I do have a question. Mr. Bender, this show your fiscal impact shows about an $800,000 expenditure impact to the counties. Is any money provided in this bill, or is any money contemplated and provided in other bills that would offset this unfunded mandate?
There are no funds provided in this bill, and we are recommending, the LFO recommendation is that you consider funding for these costs in either the Secretary of State's budget bill, which will be before this subcommittee for public hearing at least in less than 2 weeks, or in the end of session bill. But we are not, we do not have amendments that we are bringing to you.
This bill does not address, this bill does not address the unfunded mandate.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. Before we start with any further questions and before we invite people from the Secretary of State's office up to testify, I'd like to say two things. First of all, welcome to our guests. It's a little rare to get a lot of folks into general government. We're kind of the boring subcommittee that nobody pays attention to, so welcome to all of you. And second of all, I would remind members of the committee what we talked about yesterday. We are here to discuss the fiscal impacts. The question Senator Whitsitt asked was exactly on target. It's a fiscal question. The policy decisions, the discussion has been held, and that's our intention here today, is to focus on fiscal aspects.
Madam Chair, with due respect, it's my understanding that this bill came to Ways and Means and it will not have a hearing in the Senate. Is that correct?
As per usual custom, Senator.
You may have to get security to have me take it kicking out of this room if you restrict my questions to a certain length. I'm just giving you that warning right now.
Yes. I would also remind members who are visiting, members of the public who are visiting with us today, that if you wish to speak, there's a sign-up sheet available. We do have the opportunity for public testimony as part of this public hearing. Otherwise, we request that you restrict your verbal statements, because we need to stay focused, and anything that's said in here needs to be on public record, and we can't hear you on the recording system. I'm going to call a brief recess for the moment. We're in recess. Julie, well, I'm sorry, but I did. Julie, can you? Just to clarify, the witnesses will only be providing testimony on fiscal issues. Members are certainly welcome to ask questions, but what I'm asking of the people testifying is to focus on the fiscal issue. So, Senator, you're certainly always welcome to ask any questions you want, just to clarify.
And to clarify, you're giving the witnesses the instructions not to answer questions. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
I am giving the witnesses similar instructions to what my co-chair gave the witnesses yesterday, which is that we're trying to focus on budget issues here.
Are you directly asking them not to respond to questions that you choose are not budget issues? Is that correct?
I would strongly prefer, Senator, that we use this budget committee to focus on budget issues. That has been, I cannot compel you or the witnesses to restrict your questions or your testimony, and I would not choose to do so. That would be inappropriate. But I would urge this committee to stay focused on the budget issues, and this is the process that we've used in the legislature for some time with joint ways and means. I recognize that it creates difficulties because we don't have a policy hearing on the Senate side, but this is not a new bill, although there are significant changes, which I will ask our witnesses just to clarify when they come up.
To clarify, this is a new bill. Every session only has new bills. Bills are not carried over from one session to the other. Is that correct?
I was imprecise in my language, Senator. You're correct. This is not a carried over bill. There is no such thing. It is a topic that we have considered at some length in previous sessions. And substantively, this bill has significant similarities. And I will ask the witnesses when they come up, from the Secretary of State's office, to clarify for this committee, since some of us were on the committee in the past and some of us were not, the similarities and differences between the version that we saw in 2013 and now, because I think that would be helpful to members of the committee. Other thoughts, Senator, before I invite our witnesses up? Other members of the committee? Thank you. Ms. Zedlick, Mr. Taylor?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick. I am Chief of Staff for the Secretary of State. Robert Taylor, Deputy Secretary of State, is also here, and we are here to testify on House Bill 2177. LFO did a great job of summarizing our fiscal costs, but to your request of going through an overview of the bill with major changes, I will start with that. I think the biggest change from last time, we did introduce a bill in 2013 that looked at a very similar concept. What's before you in House Bill 2177 is a bill that deals only with DMV, does not go to any other agency. There were other designated voter registration agencies that were part of the bill in 2013, if any of you remember. This bill deals directly with the DMV, with the Secretary of State's office, and of course it affects counties.
And Ms. Zidlick, I'm going to apologize for interrupting you, but I would ask that when you point out differences, if you could talk about why those changes were made, that would be helpful to the committee.
Sure.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, the biggest reason for that change is that we already have a working relationship with DMV. We already have an online voter registration system that looks at, calls forth your ODL number and uses that connection. It was it's a connection that we already have. So, and they are specifically called out in federal law as a place where people should register to vote. So I think it was since 1993. So there's been a connection between our two agencies for a long time. So we decided to narrow it and make it with the hopes that we can focus and make it work really well. Other changes include we extended the period of time for opting out being added to any voter registration rolls. I believe last time it was a 2-week window, and we've expanded that to a 3-week window. Of course, voters may opt out at any time, all the time. This would be under the provisions of this bill. If you for sure do not ever want to be added to a voter registration roll, you have a window of time where that won't happen. So we've extended that window of time. And I think importantly, we've had an eye towards implementation. We've been working with the county clerks since we introduced the bill last time, and in the interim, and we've made some decisions on implementation after working with them to look at bringing a number. Obviously, this will increase voter registration. We've looked to do it in a more phased-in way, and we've heard those concerns. So that's another big change. And let's see. I think that summarizes the major changes in the bill this time.
Okay, thank you. And then whatever else you were going to say, we'd love to hear about it. Thank you.
Mr. Bender went through the fiscal impact. I mean, he basically said what I was going to say. I think we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And before we get to that, we have the privilege of having Co-Chair Devlin here with us today. And while I don't want to put you on the spot, Senator, Mr. Bender alluded to the fact that the recommendation from LFO is that that funds to support the counties be included in the Secretary of State's budget or as part of the omnibus bill at the end of session. Would it be appropriate for you to offer any thoughts on that right now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could offer my thoughts. I could not necessarily offer Representative Buckley's thoughts.
Perfectly reasonable.
But we have had discussions of this, Chair. Obviously, the Secretary of State's impacts would be covered by HAVA funds, mm-hmm. at least the immediate impacts. And most of it for the Secretary of State are immediate impacts.
And just to clarify for the audience, HAVA is the Help America Vote Act. Those are federal funds that came to states to help improve voter registration and participation. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
And in recognition of the impact on counties in terms of the county clerks, their elections, officers, and the cost there, we recognize that this will be an additional cost to counties. As Mr. Bender indicated, the cost estimate we have is a high cost estimate based on levels that we actually do not believe it will probably get to. So we will probably look for some mechanism to determine what those costs are. We'll probably, my guess, I'll speak for myself, we would probably do something that we normally always do. We will allocate so much through the Secretary of State to give to the counties for these costs. We'll probably retain a portion of whatever we allocate to release later, depending upon actual costs. And a third item out there that you did not ask, but I think I should address because I think it's good for the record. We want to be careful how we do this because the co-chairs are always concerned about expanding responsibilities for the state as long in addition to mandates. And for local elections, we traditionally only cover the cost when we actually or a significant portion of the cost when we actually call the election, not for regular elections. So when we call a special election that is on a date other than a normal date, we will normally pay a significant amount of that cost. Starting to pay for this cost is actually a growth in that responsibility. We want to make it sure that it's understand that our growth in that responsibility is limited. And not that all of you, particularly those of you that have been on Ways and Means for a long time, we want to make sure that our understanding with our county partners is accurate so that we don't see actually additional requests to cover more costs at the local level than we're potentially agreeing to.
Thank you.
Go to Pandora's box.
Questions? Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Taylor. Who will maintain custody of the database of potential voter registrants who are too young to vote?
Senator, my name is Robert Taylor. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. For those, as I understand the bill, for those people who are not yet 18, that data will be maintained in DMV and will not be transferred to us.
By DMV.
May I clarify?
Ms. Zedlick would like to clarify that answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Whitsett, members of the committee, so today, under current law, 17-year-olds may register to vote. So currently, those registrations are on OCVR, our centralized voter registration system. They are public record today. What that provision in this bill does is sort of unrelated to the rest of the bill, because what it does is it withholds those names of 17-year-olds who will not be 18 by the next election, and it withholds that from public record releases. So that actually is just a protective measure. Right now, that is a public, they are public records today. I think what Robert was getting at was that under the bill, I don't think we don't intend to offer voter registration in this opt-out manner to anyone who is 17. We would only contact people who are 18 and older. So they're related but separate issues.
Thank you. Follow-up question.
Certainly.
So the bill protects the records from disclosure pursuant to a public records request. And as I understand it,
but or a voter list request, which is often made.
Does it? So it does protect the list against requests that are not public records requests, but for distribution to any other entity.
I believe you could only do a public records request, or a lot of time. There's a specific statute on voter lists that have to do with campaigns, and it would also be protected
from
that.
So this list could not be sold to a political party or a commercial interest. Is that correct?
Senator, that is correct.
Thank you. Follow up?
Please.
This bill purports to register as many as 425,000 unaffiliated voters. What effect might that have on a minority party status in Oregon?
Well, we've in Section 9, we've looked to try and address that, because one way to achieve and maintain a minor party is to register a certain number of the total, certain percentage of the total number of registered voters. So increasing the number of registered voters makes it more difficult to become a minor political mm-hmm. party. We've tried to address that in the bill. We see that coming with a big influx, and what that section essentially aims to do is sort of press a pause button to give the minor parties that struggle to maintain status mm-hmm. More time to have voters affiliate with their party.
Okay. Follow up.
Please.
This bill has an emergency clause on it, and so that would appear to leave a window of about 4 months between the time it takes effect and the time that this provision would go into effect. So could you discuss how that might affect the minority parties?
Section 9. Thank you, Senator. Just give me 1 minute to look at it.
I think it's
So are you, I'm looking at section 9 right now in the bill, and it freezes the number of registered voters as of July 1 of this year.
Ms. Edlich, maybe I could clarify or ask a question that might help us clarify. There would not be an immediate transfer of all current registrants from DMV. This would only happen when someone came in to renew his or her driver's license, to file an address change, or to obtain a new driver's license. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair. I understand what you're asking now. No, we do not foresee the 400 plus thousand is predicted over the entire course of the biennium. It is in no one's interest that clerks and it would defeat the purpose of Section 9 if we did it in brought in a large number of voters prior to that date. That is not the intent.
And then we're going to let some other people ask some questions real quick.
I'm sorry?
Yes, and then after this one, if we could, we'd like to ask, let some other members, and then we can come back to you.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead for this one, please.
The Secretary of State's office had some significant problem with hacking on ORSTAR, and I think that was handled quite nicely over the period of time when you were under fire. But the fact of the matter is it did happen, and I don't believe that the source was ever identified in entirety. So how are you going to protect this database from that sort of hacking?
Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, there's a couple things. OCVR is maintained differently than our other applications. For the biggest difference is that it's not a public-facing application. You know, the public can go and interact with ORSTAR, so there's an avenue in. So OCVR is used only by elections officials. So that's helpful. I mean, that's one way of protecting that.
It was my understanding that DMV is going to keep these records and then transfer them to you in a timely manner. How is DMV's records going to be protected?
This is Robert Taylor and Co-Chair Steiner here with Senator Whitsitt. We would defer to DMV to talk about their security protocols they have in place for our data. As for the Secretary of State's office and the February outage, the specific issue in our agency that led to the breach has been fixed. Mm-hmm. And that has given us confidence in our applications. Coming out of that breach, I don't know that there's another agency in state government that has a higher level of sensitivity to security of their data. And one of the things we're asking for in our budget that will come before this committee is to help us refortify our systems. And you'll see that in a policy option package that will come before this committee. And we will ask this committee to help us do some of that fortification and rebuilding by giving us those resources.
Mr. Taylor, I appreciate that. But the question was, how will DMV protect theirs? And I understand the answer. You don't know, and we'd have to ask DMV.
DMV would speak to the security they have in
their
system.
And Mr. Taylor, if I could just remind you, we have ridiculously sensitive microphones, so feel free to keep a little more distance so we don't have so much feedback. Representative Hurd, thank you, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that I really want an answer to. What is inspiring the Secretary of State's office, since this is a budget committee, to spend extra money to force the citizens of Oregon that are unregistered to register, when I was just at the DMV on Friday in Roseburg, and the person to my right was asked clearly by the employee, would you like to register to vote?
Representative Hurd, members of the committee, I'm glad to hear that the DMV is asking people to register to vote. That's great. I think the Secretary's vision is that she would like to see a ballot in the hands of every eligible Oregonian, and we don't see it as forcing registration. We see this as voters having the same volition they always have. It's an opt-out instead of an opt-in.
Follow-up.
Certainly.
What is your definition of forcing?
we will send them a notification under the bill and say,
yep. I'm not interested in your definition of forcing. What is the definition of forcing?
I don't have a dictionary in front of me. I'm sorry, Representative.
Well, maybe the Secretary of State's office should look it up, because that's what you are doing. And you're spending the state's money to do it. People aren't asking you to make them register. They have that right already. They're already asked. They don't need you to do that. And there are people that actually in this state and in this nation and in this world that have religious reasons for why they do not want to be registered. And even though you're giving them an opt-out, you are forcing them to be registered. And that's wrong. And you want us to spend money through this committee to do it. And I want to know why.
Can I just clarify something? I want you to answer the representative's question as best you can, but I want to clarify something. If I understand the bill correctly, a person will not actually be registered to vote until the end of the three-week period that they have for the opt-out. So they will never actually be registered to vote unless, if they return that card within the three-week period. Is that correct?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Hurd, that is correct. They will not be registered to vote unless we do not hear from them in that three-week period. And again, we believe very strongly in voter volition. They're free to opt out at any time. They will be able to opt out on that card. They can opt out by calling their clerk, by going online today. There's lots of ways to exercise their power not to be registered to vote.
Follow up. That's not answering my question. You are telling me that once someone is forced, they have the option to then leave the van, so to speak. You had to force them to this point for them then to get off the boat. Whether it's 3 weeks or 30 seconds, the fact of the matter is you're putting them on the boat of registration, you're setting them a sail, and then you're saying you can row yourself back if you want to. You're making them go through a process with the state of Oregon to then get off the boat that you by force, by anybody's definition, except for the Secretary of State's office, I guess, made them register to vote. Why is that? What is the motivation behind that?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Hurd, we have had a very long and proud record in Oregon over many years of reducing the barriers to voting. We have the voter's pamphlet statement, we have vote by mail, we have online registration. All of those things are a series of steps to make it easier for people to exercise their fundamental right to vote. This is another step in that history. That's why the Secretary of State feels strongly about this bill.
So my follow-up to that is, so I applaud you and the Secretary of State's office for removing the obstacles, as you put it. But ironically now, you're actually forcing somebody to register and then setting up an obstacle that they now have to jump back over to get back to where they wanted to be in the first place. Because as I said, anytime anybody who is eligible goes into the DMV or has access to the internet has the full right and access to be registered to vote. So again, why are you forcing people to now jump back over an obstacle that you so proudly said you were removing?
Representative Hurd.
And costing the state money, which pertains to this budget committee.
Mr. Taylor, Ms. Edlich, you can choose to answer if you want, but I think you've done an admirable job of answering the first part of that question with regard to initially. Co-Chair Smith?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. It's not always fun getting grilled on difficult policy bills, and please send our best to the Secretary of State. The one question I do have is on Section 12. Can you just help this committee understand why that is a necessary part of this legislation?
Representative Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, I believe you're referring to the emergency clause in Section 12. These are often added to elections bills. Mainly it is so that we can get started on this project as soon as possible. We are looking at a presidential election year in the coming year, and in working closely with the counties, the more time that we have to figure out a phased in process makes it better for all the agencies and the counties involved.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the question of the computer and the failures of the computer system in the Secretary's office, and I appreciate your answer. I've had a preview from you, Mr. Taylor, about your budget request. You're asking for 10 more information technology people. I would like to know the correlation between the request for those 10 more and the sort of history of data integrity, whether it's ORSTAR or other systems that have been hacked or compromised in the Secretary of State Brown's office.
So though that policy option package, Senator Johnson and Co-Chair Senator Hayward, that policy option package is package 100. It is separate than the fiscal impact of this bill. Those 10 positions are spread across the agency to support the various different parts of the agency in the Secretary of State's office. A net 3 FTEs would be devoted to elections, and the other 7 would be spread across audits, archives, corporation, and administrative services. So that's how that works. 2 of those FTEs in Package 100 are devoted to ORSTAR, which is, it is commonly thought of as the campaign finance application. It's actually 8 different modules that have been tacked together over the course of many years. That's the application we believe needs the most attention in elections, and that's why it's the focus in Package 100. OCVR is the separate application. That is, our vendor there is Hewlett-Packard. They have done a very good job, and we are confident in them. So that's at least how the technology works in our office and how Package 100 and those positions relate to that. And then as far as data integrity in our office, we did have the breach. We did have the breach in February, and we have taken steps since then to correct that immediate problem. And we do have a new IT director in our office. And one of the things we asked him is, tell us what you need so that we won't have to go through this again. And that's why he helped us develop Package 100. Mr. Bender then asked us to prioritize it and show everybody how it's spread across the agency, and we've done that. And we'll be talking more about that, I know, in a couple of weeks.
Thank you. I have a question for you. One of the concerns that I've heard about this bill relates to ensuring that the people who are registered in this manner are, in fact, legal U.S. citizens. My understanding is that anybody who's coming in to get a new driver's license at this point or to renew his or her driver's license has to go according to the Federal Real ID Act, and that means that he or she has to provide one of a fairly limited set of documents, such as a U.S. passport, or a certified copy of his or her birth certificate showing that he or she was born in the United States or on a U.S. military installation to a U.S. citizen, one of those appropriate things. And I'm not even sure there are many others that would qualify. And so can you see a way, leaving aside the possibility of forged documents, that somebody who wasn't a citizen could end up registered to vote under this new bill?
Madam Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, the only people who would be registered after the opt-out period under 2177 are those who have affirmatively proven their citizenship to the DMV, either through a passport or an original birth certificate. And we believe that's one of the benefits of this law, because currently, either online or in paper, you check the box and attest that you're a citizen. So under the new law, folks that would go through the registration process are those who've actually provided documentation to DMV.
So just to clarify, if I may, just for one moment, Senator. So currently, if somebody were a legal resident via a green card, for example, so they were living here legally but were not a U.S. citizen, they could get, with that green card, a driver's license. And
in theory, because they had an Oregon driver's license, they could go online and register to vote, because all you have to do is put in your driver's license number. And would DMV at that point kick that back and say, no, you can't register, you're not a citizen, because that information would be in DMV's database? Or is it possible that using the current system, somebody who was not a citizen could register to vote?
So under this bill, when we do the data transfer, that some of that accounts actually for some of our costs, is we look to filter out people who have proven citizenship. So we don't look at, oh, do you have a license? Send us your information. We say, have you proven citizenship? Send us your information. So under this bill, only citizens will be contacted to register for the opt-out manner. Under any other voter registration currently here and across the country, any other voter registration way to register to vote, someone can falsely attest to their citizenship.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I recall, although I'm a little misty on some of the details, that there was a huge breach of data in some years back at DMV. Hundreds of thousands of records are out in the public domain. What do you do about those in terms of security or identification of people legally entitled to vote when those records slipped away from DMV?
Senator Johnson, Co-Chair Steiner here. We would defer to DMV to talk about their history with the data and what security measures they have in place.
Madam Chair, are we going to have the opportunity to hear from DMV? I see some of their folks in the back of the room.
I'd be more than happy to invite them up. I just want to clarify, though, the issues around DMV's data security are there regardless of whether we pass this bill or not. Is that not correct, or am I misunderstanding? Because they're not going to be the information that they have will be identical regardless of whether they transfer it to the Secretary of State's office or not. Is that not correct? Am I missing something?
Don't ask me. I'm not a witness.
Well, I know, but I want to understand the question, Senator. I'm not trying to be disrespectful in the slightest. I'm trying to understand the question. The data that DMV has on Oregonians, they will have regardless of whether they send that to the Secretary of State or not?
Wouldn't that be a question for DMV to answer?
Sure. DMV, somebody, come on up. Thank you. Ms. Edlich, Mr. Taylor, if you don't mind just sharing the space a little bit, that'd be awesome. We can just share microphones, or however we need to do it. And please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation representing the DMV, and with me, Daryl Ficker from our budget office. If I may, to address, I believe, Senator Johnson's question about a data breach, I believe what you may be referring to, Senator, is many years ago, before the data at DMV was actually protected, it was legal to buy that data from DMV. There, every once in a while, maybe once or twice a year, there will be something in the paper about this CD is floating around with all kinds of names and addresses of people, and there's been a breach of DMV's database. No, actually, it's a CD that's been floating around for 10 years or something from back when it was legal for that data to go out. I am not aware of any sort of data breach of the type you're talking about, Senator, at any point in time.
Is any of that data that was out in the public square relevant to anything that this bill speaks to?
Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Senator Johnson, I do not believe so, no.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's probably necessary, but I'll do it anyway. I'm trying to think back. I believe it was my first session here in 1997 when this issue first became apparent of DMV was selling data. Mm-hmm. I know that only because I was carrying a totally unrelated bill on the floor, and all the news stories were about breach of confidentiality. And this bill was a simple bill from the ombudsman for the people that live in manufactured housing so that they could waive their confidentiality so somebody could come to their assistance in a very quick period of time. And I only remember this because we had to pull the bill back for like 2 months from the House floor because the members were associating the two issues and they had nothing to do with one another. But I think it's been actually that long. I think it was either 97 or 99. When that happened.
Thank you.
But I think the legislature put in appropriate restrictions on what data could, with the cooperation of the Motor Vehicle Division, and what could be released and what cannot.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, I know you'd had some questions earlier about DMV security. Since we do have the opportunity to speak with them, are there questions you'd like to bring back up at this point?
So, yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
It appears that this, you're going to be holding a repository of potential voter registration, people who have been signed up to get a driver's license but who are not yet of age eligible to get a driver's license, to get a registered to vote. So you're going to be maintaining that that vessel of names and addresses and so forth. And again, in this bill, it says that those are not subject to public records disclosure, but it nowhere does it say that you can't share them with someone else on your own volition. Can you think of any time or reason that you might be inclined to or compelled to share that vessel of names and with anyone else under any circumstances?
Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Whitsitt, if I can back up just to a bit about how this works. I mean, I think fundamentally DMV has a large data set,
mm-hmm.
names, addresses, citizenship, legal permanent resident, age, all kinds of information having nothing to do with voter registration, having to do with driver licensure, identification cards. That data set is subject to state law regarding privacy, who has legal access to which parts of that data and who does not. That is existing state law. With the bill coming in and effectively doing an exchange of information, I mean, DMV already has that data and already has restrictions on what can be released to whom. The change that the bill would allow Secretary of State to pull data, and there are restrictions on them, doesn't change the existing state law on the restrictions upon the department on what we may do with our data that already exists completely independent of voter registration. I hope that answered your question, but I will try again if it did not.
Thank you. Follow up.
Please.
You said the data that can be released to whom, and that was really the crux of my question, whom may you release that data to?
Sure.
Currently, because apparently that now there's another part of my question, which I had not yet articulated, and that is, if this is all part of a single database, then when you provide these names of the 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds to the Secretary of State, will that be just in the entire database, or do you have it somewhere separate so you can give it to them in one piece, or they're kind of just, are they going to have to sort through the whole database to find them, or do you have it in a separate vessel, so to speak? My age is showing there's no such thing as a vessel in the computer.
It's quite all right. We understand, Senator.
Steiner Hayward and Senator Whitsitt, my IT knowledge is, I think, probably comparable with yours. What DMV collects in terms of age is a date of birth. We don't collect your age. We collect a date of birth. So my understanding would be that data would be pulled as appropriate under the bill. Those folks who are eligible to register under the bill. I can't tell you if that's 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds. That's a question of what's in the bill. And whether that data set is all together is an IT question that I did not come prepared to answer. I could probably get that information to you pretty readily. But whether it's one giant file or little separate bits of data that travel separately, I can't answer that for you.
Okay.
I would request that that you provide myself and the it to the committee administrator, and they'll distribute it to all of us. Specifically, how you intend to handle those, whether it's as a total database or an individual database or somewhere in between, and also what purposes you can distribute that information for from under your current law from the Department of Motor Vehicles. If you would do that, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Senator. Colleagues, at this point, I know my co-chair has another question. I know that we have members of the public who are waiting to testify, and I want to be sure that we have time for members of the public to testify. And I know that people from the Secretary of State's office may have other obligations. So, Co-Chair Smith, do you have another question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I guess this is for question of folks who will be testifying. I'm naive here. I need to understand the concern we have of this data as it relates to 17 and 16-year-olds, and who do we think is going to grab it, and what are they going to do with it? And so I'm not asking that sarcastically. I'm just trying to figure out what is that scenario that people are envisioning that I'm not.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I will just say that one of the main reasons it's in the bill from our perspective is that this was a big concern in the floor debates, the House floor debates on our last bill last session. So
are they thinking someone's going to take this information and sell it?
I think
in the age of Facebook, Twitter, all this other stuff, I'm trying to figure out about a 17-year-old boy on 190 Rock Street in Heppner.
To call out any particular children.
I'm not being facetious.
No,
I'm trying
you're
to
not.
Figure out
no,
what's
right.
the issue.
No, right. I understand the point. I think
so when people testify, I'd love to. I'd love to be educated on this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Hurd, I know you have a question. Is it critical that we ask the Secretary of State's people right now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I'm asking again is because it was not answered the last time I asked it. The Jehovah's Witnesses religion refuses to register to vote. So again, as a budget committee, why are we spending money on forcing people of faith, or anybody for that matter, who does not want to vote?
Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, Representative Hurd. Again, we do not believe we are forcing people to register to vote. We feel that the opt-out is very strong, and a Jehovah's Witness who wishes not to be a part of that voter registration roll has the ability to remain off of it.
Follow-up.
If it's quick.
It will be, if they make it quick. Secretary of State does not have the power to redefine the word force. You are forcing by the deck. By the dictionary.
You've made this point several times. I appreciate
But they have not answered the question.
I don't think they're going to be able to answer the question any better than you have.
Because there isn't a good answer.
I think you've made your point, sir.
Yes,
and I appreciate
you
bringing it up.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Taylor?
Co-Chair Steiner Hubert, I just want to put on the record something that was brought up earlier, because it is something that's very important to the Secretary of State. And you will hear from folks from the counties, I think a little bit later. It is very important from the Secretary of State's perspective that the counties receive the financial support that they need as our county partners to implement this bill. Mr. Bender did a very good job of describing the estimates for the number of new voters we expect to bring on in the biennium. That was an estimate that our office, the Secretary of State's office, prepared and gave to the counties. It is based on a comparison of people that we have identified as eligible but unregistered in the DMV database, or folks that have come in and interacted with the DMV, and then comparing them to those that are registered in the OCVR file. That's how we came up with it. Mr. Bender suggested there might be ways to whittle that number down, and that's where he's talking about maybe that's a high estimate. But it's the best available estimate we have at the time, and it's a number we gave the counties to work with.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I'm just curious, Mr. Taylor, you corrected yourself. Was this work that the Secretary of State staff did in looking at the records to identify the potential universe? So have you been scrubbing the DMV records already?
We have, as part of our online voter registration process, we do get data from the DMV, and so we have been working with the DMV to prepare the estimates of the voters we would bring in, and we gave those numbers to the county. So I just wanted to make it clear, before you beat up the counties on the estimate of voters, that number came from us. We gave that to them.
But to be clear, Mr. Taylor, you're not saying you've identified specific individuals. You've just done a cross match, an anonymous cross match. Am I correct? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. You have not actually gone and identified specific individuals. You've just done a cross match based on how many people have driver's licenses in the state currently compared to how many are registered to vote.
And as long as you're asking my question, why don't you ask about applicable age, too?
You mean, are we talking about 16-year-olds, or are we talking about...
I don't know.
My understanding is that this bill does nothing to change the legal age of registration. That remains at 17, which it currently is. Is that correct, Mr. Taylor?
That's correct.
Thank you. And is that your question, Senator? I'm not trying to barge in your question. I want to make sure we're asking the right questions. I want to understand.
Thank you.
No, I'm please.
No,
like
I'm
this.
Done.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you both very much. I understand Ms. Zedlick has to leave. Mr. Taylor, if you'd be willing to stay, I'd be grateful. Thank you. I'd like to call Rob Bovet and Art Harvey to the stand, please. Thank you. And for those of you who, you can step down if you want, Mr. Taylor. I'll just grab you a foot. Well, it's up to you. I don't really care. There. You guys can stay. I would just like to remind people we have a half hour left for this committee. We had hoped to continue with our work with the Department of Administrative Services. That's pretty clear. It's not going to happen. But I am going to ask people to be concise both in their testimony and in their questions. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Co-chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm a legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks, who I also represent. With me today is Art Harvey, the Josephine County Clerk. We're primarily here to answer your questions, if you have any, about the fiscal done by the counties. Art is the primary person who worked on it using Secretary of State's number. The other thing I would just comment on is my strong message from my client AOC is please, please, please fund this. This has to be funded. I agree with what Mr. Taylor said before. This is a good estimate. It's a good, solid estimate. I don't know that it's high at all, but I agree with Senator Devlin that you can structure it in a way that puts it in the Secretary of State's budget but doesn't dole it out to the counties until we actually know the cost. That makes sense to me, but I would also encourage you to put it in the Secretary of State's budget and not leave it till the end. And with that, that's pretty much what we had to communicate, and Art and I are happy to answer any questions you have about the county's part of it.
Thank you. Do you want to add anything, sir? Or is that, or just wait to ask questions for questions?
I'm here for questions.
Thank you, Senator.
If it comes to the counties, Mr. Bovet, as an unfunded mandate, what's AOC's position on the bill?
Right now, AOC has taken no position on the bill and sent me into this building to urge that you fund it. If you don't fund it in the Secretary of State's line item, I can't necessarily predict what my client's reaction would be. I know that's not the full answer, but that's
not any answer.
I know. I understand.
You're
that's,
good.
That's the answer that I have for you here today.
Thank you.
He's an attorney.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Bovet? Senator Whitsitt, Representative Hurd, Taylor, Nathanson, Co-Chair Smith. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and I'll be grateful if you hang tight for just a minute. Kay Bridges, Mike Marsh, Ruth Bendel, and Sharon Cornish, if you'd all be kind enough to join us, please. Yeah, feel free to just grab another chair.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Bendel. Do I have to give my address or something?
Nope. No. You just have to identify yourself. Thank you. And if you're affiliated with any specific group, we appreciate knowing that. If you're just here as an individual citizen, that's fine.
I'm PCP.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm really concerned with all of the national news about the actual cost or funding that there's going to be to prevent the hacking of the data, both at the county level, the Secretary of State's level, and the DMV level, in terms of making Oregon Terragate. because our adversaries know where we are vulnerable. Our electoral system with vote by mail and online voting is vulnerable. We've seen what's happened with hacking. So, and even at the national level, they haven't even come up with a sum of money to prevent hacking of data with companies and government. And I have to tell you that having been at Washington County elections, I do know that there are people coming in daily, particularly months prior to the election, and they are going through the electoral roll on the computer, and they can even get the signatures. Our adversaries know where this can be done. They know that they can do ID theft on electoral rolls elsewhere, bring those people in from other states even, and utilize the fact that we're not fully funded for actually stopping these breaches. So I'm asking you, you've got an emergency clause there before you even have the answer for dealing with that hacking risk, and our adversaries are probably salivating for this. So please come up with an answer of how many millions of dollars you're going to need when Sony and other companies are still battling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bendel. What I'd like to do is hear from all members of the panel, and I understand there's a fifth person, Mr. Johnston. We'll get to you in just a moment, sir. Whoever's next, please.
Hey, Bridges. I'm a precinct committee person. I'll talk about the money second. But the first thing I think of when you talk about registering the young people who have driver's licenses, if they've registered, they've consented to it. If you register them, they haven't consented to it. And I think that is an invasion of privacy, which is protected, I do believe, under some
statutes.
We just,
thank you.
No, that's...
No, I wasn't. I was just asking members of the audience not to applaud or make noise because I can't hear you. And regardless of whether you agree or disagree, that's fine. I'm eager to do that, but I really want to be able to hear the witnesses. Cool, go for it. That's fine. But
okay.
I would like to be able to hear our witnesses. Thank you.
When staff was reciting the, I actually didn't get to read this. I was reading the amendments that had been proposed about how this is in conflict with some ORS statutes. And then I heard $70,000 here and a $70,000 plus there, and then another $40,000 over here, and then 10 more people, but only three of them for this purpose. I think it's astronomical, wasted money to ask people in an economy like this to register to vote when they should have the integrity and the conviction to vote on their own. This should not be a forced issue. I applaud Representative Hurd's comments on forcing. I had not even thought about it quite that way, but it's forcing anybody. And then they negate, and you're spending money to do it when we need, well, if I have to say it, good roads right now instead of spending money this way. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time for the testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Bridges. Ms. Cornish.
My name is Sharon Cornish. I've been involved in elections for over 45 years, even hired once. I have no confidence in DMV. Too many up front on the counter have been put there because they speak Spanish. And I'll give you an example. My husband was a legal Canadian here. He went to the Korean War. He had a choice in high school, reject it and stay a Canadian, or accept it and become naturalized. He accepted. He had all the pictures with the big staff and everything in getting his naturalization papers, all the paperwork, everything. When his driver's license expired, he went in to get it redone. Nobody on the counter would give him a driver's license. And he came home and was going to drive anyway. I said, oh, no, you're not. So I took his paperwork, and I went in and asked for the administrator. Mm-hmm. I showed him everything, all the paperwork of him receiving his naturalization, everything, all of the letters of recommendation, blah, blah, blah. And he said, here, fill this, have him fill this out. It was 2 pages to Homeland Security. I said, where do I send it? There was no address on it. He took it back, and he threw it in the trash. And he said, I want 4 pieces of ID, and he left. And he was gone for about 20 minutes. He came back, and he said, I'll put paper clips on these 4 items. Tell him to come back. I said, what's your name? And he gave me his name. My husband went back. He got his driver's license. Now you are wanting 16-year-olds to be in part of the database of DMV? Uh-uh.
Ms. Cornish, just to be clear, the requirements for your husband were imposed by the federal government, and those are part of the Real ID Act, which are designed to make sure that people getting licenses are legitimately in the country. Your husband's story, unfortunately, is not uncommon, and it has nothing to do with their nation of origin. It has everything to do with the challenges imposed on...
You shouldn't have to ask for the administrator.
Okay. We're going to have to leave that part aside at the moment, ma'am. I appreciate your concern, but 16-year-olds are already part of this, and they already have to provide the same ID, and they can't register for vote currently, and they won't be able to under the current law.
And who's going to keep record of that?
Their birth date will. Their birth date doesn't change. Thank you, Ms. Cornish. Mr. Marsh.
I'm Michael Marsh. I'm a third-party activist. Betty Comp is my state representative. Thank you, Chairwoman Hayward and committee. As a third-party activist, I have helped quite a few people register to vote. You know, 18-year-olds who are voting for the first time, and they like what I have to say, so I'll help them register. And people that haven't voted for a while, and it turns out they're no longer on the roll, so they need to re-register. The whole process takes less than a minute. So why do we need this automatic voter registration? If a person isn't willing to take a minute, now, I applaud the Secretary of State's office for the voter pamphlet. I love it. But if they're not willing, a person isn't willing to take 30 seconds, 45 seconds to fill out a card, are they going to take 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes to read the voter pamphlet statements? So, and this is very much a fiscal issue, because especially for the House of Representatives, that's where the taxes start. That's, you know, the revenue starts. And if they are voting because of something, a 30-second ad that they either liked or disliked, what kind of quality of people are we having to vote? So I would urge a no vote on this.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you all for taking the time. We really value citizen participation and multiple voices in the conversation. Really appreciate your making the effort to come down and talk with us today. Thank you very much. Mr. Johnston, we've got about 3 minutes before we have to wrap up. So we're looking forward to your comments, but we're going to ask you to keep them concise. Thank you so much.
I'll keep extremely precise.
Awesome.
Most people in this building know me. My name is Edward Johnston from Lincoln County. I'm still having my life threatened by the sheriff, deputy, and everybody down there because I'm not complying to the British government standards. I am not a registered voter. I rescinded my contract with the state. And because I rescinded my contract with the state, everybody's still trying to kill me. I'm against this bill. I am going to serve you right now what I served Eric Holder. This is an act of piracy which you're committing, and anybody under 17 years old is forced to sign anything, it's a federal crime, not only a state crime. They're not old enough. They're not old enough to make decisions or lawful anything. We're not talking legal. We're talking lawful. I'm a registered nothing. I'm an American. I've given up my rights now to the British government. Where did I put it? Let me finish, please. I have these things for recreational vehicle, because in the state of Oregon, you do not need a license. You do not need license plates. I've made my own plate that I'm being threatened with. I have the Oregon state law right here. I'm turning this into the committee. I've emailed all of you in this House and Senate what I've served. I'll be serving this document, too, on this bill. And I know Rob Avett personally. He was the first one who taught me how to write my first instrument. But we have a disagreement. That's why he resigned in Lincoln County. And what is really disturbing, and I have the filing right here with the court and the newspaper on the private side, what I filed, I'm entering this into record. Okay? We, the people of the state of Oregon, have a lawful right not to participate in the rights to travel by your privilege. As a registered voter, I give up my lawful rights to you to represent me. You tell me I'm a child. When I go to court, I'm told I'm a child if I have an attorney. Now, in Lincoln County, I have the videos up where I'm being threatened by the deputy, where I'm being threatened by the attorney and the judge. They're on YouTube video. Type in Ed Johnson, Toledo, Oregon. Attorney McCrum threatening me and telling me that if they murder me, it's called a homicide. Murder is okay in the state of Oregon legally. The videos are on YouTube. I've been on talk shows over this and doing a lot of talk shows over on this. Our rights to vote, when you take an oath to office, all right, when you get your paycheck, and by federal law, there's actually no technical oath for you guys, but federal law says the minute you cash your first paycheck, you have to go by the Constitution. What you have in your emails, the actual notarized copy from the Queen of England and the Vatican, that the one-page Constitution is the law of this land, technically 48 states, now 50. All right? And you have that registration from the Queen of England and the Vatican. I know I've emailed it, and I'll re-email it to everybody. It's been published in the newspapers on the coast. This is the law of the land. Now, either we start respecting our children and educating them so this way they know, and by Oregon state law and federal law, at the age of 18, before a kid could graduate from school, they're supposed to know contract law and the Constitution, as law says.
Mr. Johnson, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up in the next 30 seconds.
But yep.
Thank you so much, sir.
And I forgot my plate back there, but I do have a copy of my plate, and I will be turning in the audio copy. I've been this copy.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
The one thing with the license, let me bring up one quick point, that I'm asking people for an amendment on things with DMV. Okay? When it comes down to this rights that we have, I'm a subsistence hunter and fisherman. For years I've been talking about it up here in this building. Most people know me in this building. All right? And I keep getting threatened, if I don't pay the privilege, I will be killed. I have been shot at. I have almost been beat to death by the cops. All this is on record. Okay? And everybody tells me, and I just got told by Senator Robin's office, if you don't like it, sue us. Where does it come where the people don't have any rights and we're being threatened if we don't register with you to give up our rights and to give our assets and our homes to you for your salaries and the structure of the system, which is filed in the instrument I just filed?
Okay, Mr. Johnson, I am going to have to ask you to finish now because
like
we
to
are...
In closing, in the name of God, peace and God bless Jesus, because if it ain't for us, there is no Jesus, number one. And remember, we're all from God. And if we don't pay attention to that, our children will not have no future.
Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for offering your testimony today. We appreciate it. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you so much, sir.
No problem.
Appreciate it. I'm so sorry, but we really don't have time at this point. I'm terribly sorry, but we are just running out of time for this committee. Thank you so much. Please feel free to submit written testimony because we still have time before the floor votes on this, and that will be available in our legislative information system. So please feel free to submit written testimony, and that obviously goes for anybody listening at home. You're always welcome to submit written testimony, and that will be included in the record. So we look forward to that. Okay, I am going to close a public hearing on this, and open a work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2177. Do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. Would you like a motion so that we can begin deliberating? I move House Bill 2177 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Mathenson moves House Bill 2177 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Smith, I am a no vote on this bill. This is consistent with my earlier position when the same concept was previously before the legislature. Secretary of State Brown wants this bill so badly that leadership is going to exercise their prerogative to replace my vote with Co-Chair Devlin. That's why he's been joining us today for the purpose of today's proceedings, and to move House Bill 2177 out of this committee. This bill has already been notified or had been noticed for action in Friday's full Ways and Means. I will be a no there as well.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. I have a question and a comment. The question is for Mr. Bender. Mr. Bender, would you, on the behalf of the committee, check with Legislative Council to determine whether a 16-year-old actually has legal capacity to affirm or reject a pre-registration to vote? Would you do that for us, please?
16-year-old.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My comment is on Section 12. I think more than all my other objections, Section 12, the emergency clause, is the most offensive to me. The only conceivable reason for an e-clause on this bill, whose effective date is largely January 1st, 2016, is to prevent referral to the people. That is an affront to Oregon's proud constitutional provisions for direct democracy, an affront to the constitutional right of Oregonians to oversee the work of their legislature. The Secretary of State is the chief elections officer. So I'll be a no.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the House, questions or comments? Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Colleagues, this afternoon I'm going to cast a courtesy aye vote. It's my intention, though, to be a no vote in full Ways and Means and a no vote on the House floor.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Okay, clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Mathenson.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Byrd.
Nope.
Co-Chair Smith.
Aye.
Senator Whitsett.
No.
Senator Devlin.
Aye.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward.
Aye, and please let the record show that Representative Comp is excused. Thank you. Motion passes.
Just really quickly, Madam Co-Chair.
Co-Chair.
The big dog, Co-Chair Buckley, asked that Representative Val Hoyle be the carrier on the House floor when that time is correct. And so I'm sure, Mr. Co-Chair, that might have been shared with you, but I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you very much, and that would have been my understanding as well. I will carry this to full Ways and Means. Representative Hoyle will carry this on the House floor, and I believe Senator Rosenbaum and I will co-carry this in the Senate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I am closing the work session on House Bill 2177. Thank you, colleagues, for your thoughtful questions on a very difficult topic. Thank you to members of the public who came to testify today. And unless there is further business before the committee, we're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.